Well, here I am with Chase Webster, and we first got together back in, 2007?
Right.
And we first got into contact in 2004 sometime, when I went on the internet and said, Chase Webster, where are you? and then you found out, and we've been in touch ever since.
Somebody found me.
Somebody found you. Tucked away in this quiet corner of Tennessee.
That's true.
Yeah. And for those who don't know, Gary Daniel Bruce, known as Chase Webster, was a recording artist for about 30 years in pop country, and went out there and performed rock and roll as well.
Oh yeah.
Yep. Had a number one hit in Nashville on the charts with a song that he wrote, Moody River.
Right.
How did Moody River come about, Chase?
The producer, I was doing he had a TV show, and he was also a disc jockey, and they had a tryout for the TV show, and I naturally joined that, and I got a spot on the TV show every Saturday afternoon, and then he made a connection with several people in the record business by being a disc jockey, and he wanted to produce records. And he knew that I was trying to write songs because I'd shown him some of my work and all. And so he told me if I could write a song about sex or death, that it would and make it believable and not gory, that it would probably sell a lot of records. And so I took him at his word, and I came home and I started trying to write something. And it's not easy to write about death and keep it nice.
You managed it.
But I finally pulled it off, I think, and I carried it back to him, and he liked it. And he had just contacted some guys from Philadelphia that were looking for a young white artist. And they wanted a rock and roll artist, but they took a chance on me, even though I probably sounded a little more country than what they wanted.
Yeah.
But we cut the record in Nashville. And after that, the disc jockey started playing it, and it went number one in about 4 weeks in Nashville.
It sold quite well across the South.
Yeah.
But you... Despite it, I have to say, it's a great version. I mean, you wrote it, and it's a great version. But it took everyone's favorite rock and roller to make it big all over the world.
Well, that's true, too, because the label I was with, they had some connections with Dick Clark. But about that time, Payola scandal was hitting, and everybody was afraid to push something that would seem a little in left field for them. And so the company I was with, they didn't have a whole lot of money to go out on their own. They were just going to have to use their connections to try to make the record. And they couldn't do anything with it. So then the disc jockey, who was the publisher of the song, he contacted Randy Wood, and Pat Boone recorded it. Even though Pat didn't like it,
he recorded it.
No.
Ah.
Oh, he made several statements about the song was silly and didn't make sense, but it made number one, and that was something he hadn't had in quite a while.
Yeah, of course, the listeners will gather that I was joking when I said that Pat Boone was the world's greatest rock and roller. I mean, give him his due, he had a great voice, but he gets a bad press. And, you know.
He had nice shoes. Nice white shoes.
Yeah, nice white shoes. Yeah. So that was the, and really now you've managed to, that's been placed in a couple of films or so, hasn't it?
Yeah, it was in a film called Last Boy Scout and Clay Pigeons.
Now Schwarzenegger had the Last Boy Scout, didn't he, was it?
There was...
But I don't know about the other one.
I don't remember the guy in the last one. Bruce Willis was in Last Boy Scout.
Oh, he was?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I'm not really up on a lot. That would be the 80s, would it, sometime?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. So you've done that, but it's been covered. You once sent me a couple of CDs of covers.
Yeah.
And there's been some good covers. Can you recall some of the main ones?
Yeah, it's been recorded about 20 or 21 times by different artists. And Frank Sinatra did it. Kitty Wells and Eddie Arnold of the Country People did it. Johnny Rivers, a rock and roller, he did it and did a good job. And John Fogerty, he cut it recently and had a real good record on it.
I like that one. You sent me the copy of that on the CD. I've always liked Fogerty, so that was a good version. So really, that's really your main claim to fame. You know, you've written a really cracking record and for so many people to cover it, but we haven't managed to get it into the sort of Music Hall of Fame.
Well, that is something else. Most rock and roll songs that go number one eventually go into Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but so far I hadn't been able to get it in there.
Because of the Pat Boone connection?
I think it's probably because of the Pat Boone connection.
Poor old Pat, we better leave him alone now.
He's getting old now, he's feeble.
But you did that, but that would be what, 1960?
61.
61.
Uh-huh.
But you go way back, because when you were growing up here in Paytonsville, your father was an entertainer?
Yeah. My father, he played banjo with a bluegrass group, and also he was a dancer. He did, back in those days, what they call buck and wing dancing. It was kind of like tap dancing.
All right.
And he did that, and the funny thing about it, he always wanted one of his kids to dance. I had two older brothers, neither one of them could dance, and I had a sister and myself. And we did well to walk. We couldn't dance either. So nobody inherited his dancing ability. But he did teach me some chords on the guitar, and then some of his friends he had played with, like Sam and Kurt McGee that were on the Opry, why they let me sit in with them some at home. And that was the beginning of my playing the guitar career.
Oh, that's great. So you had some of these country greats at the time, you know, actually teaching you how to play guitar.
Yeah.
And at that time, you hadn't thought about songwriting, but you thought about performing.
Yeah.
So then you went on, you got some jobs locally. I mean, we went out downtown and we went to what used to be a grocery store, and you were there at, what, 16 or something?
Yeah. I think I started at the grocery store when I was like 15 or 16. And I was a sack boy, which means you stand up at the counter and you sack groceries all day, which is real exciting. Of course, some nice looking girls come through too, you get to speak to. But I entered every contest I could find, a talent contest with singing and playing and so forth, and never won a contest in my life. And this guy came in the store one day that had a bluegrass group. And he was, somebody had told him I sang and he wanted to talk to me. And he invited me to be on his radio show, which was at that time WAGG Radio in Franklin, which was the only station around Franklin. And so I went out and did one show with him, and he told me, said, every Saturday afternoon we can use you. Of course, you didn't get paid, but who cares? You know, you get your own radio.
Well, yeah, yeah.
And I would go out every Saturday. They would let me take my lunch hour at 1 o'clock so I could go out to the radio station at 1:30 and play the 30-minute show, and then come back and go back to work and finish the day out. And I was backed up by four rhythm guitars and a fiddle. That was my band.
Real country.
Oh, yeah. But, back those days, you know, you were proud just to get picked with anybody. And we did that for, I guess, about a year and a half till they changed formats at the radio station and put disc jockeys in places where they'd had live entertainment.
when did, now Noel Bourne came in soon after that and took you under his wing, and that's when you took off.
Noel Ball was a disc jockey that had the TV show, and he also published the song Moody River, and he had all kind of connections through his disc jockey work with producers and directors and all this kind of stuff. But most of the people in Nashville that he talked to and I talked to, they always said I wasn't country enough, because at that time they were doing country. Right. I mean, strictly country. Mm. And, of course, I was wanting to do rock and roll. I had the long hair and all that, you know. But I finally, with the song, I give the song credit for the whole works. And after I got the right song, why, the people, you know, they got interested then. And even the Grand Ole Opry invited me to play on the Grand Ole Opry with a song that had gone number one pop.
So you had a band then. We didn't discuss this before when we first did an interview years ago, but you gave me the name of your band yesterday.
Yeah, it was the Blues Boys.
Right, and then there was another band after that.
Oh, that was that may have been the first band, Buck Slaughter.
Right. So, yeah, but obviously the same musicians didn't stay with you all the way through, did they?
No,
oh, okay. Because...
Well, one of the musicians that was also responsible for Moody River being as good as it was a piano player called Pig. And he was a blind boy, but he played fantastic piano. And he went on to become a staff musician at the Cutting Records in Nashville. He played with all the big stars.
But you were going out, you told me you were going out, and at the time you were playing rock and roll.
Yeah.
Yeah, because when I sent you Cliff Richard, Marty Wilde, Billy Fury stuff, you said that they were doing a lot of the stuff that you were doing with the band, doing live, and you appreciated, you know, that, excuse me, that stuff. But that single came out, Southern Sound, so you did a couple of singles with Southern Sound.
I did one.
You did one?
Just one.
That's right, and The Dreamer was the other side, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But one that I like, Sweethearts in Heaven, and that's partly Buck Owens.
That was written by Harlan Howard and Buck Owens, and I think Bluegrass entertainer Mike Wiseman, he's in the Bluegrass Hall of Fame now, I think he recorded that first. And then I think Buck recorded it country, and it's been recorded by several people since.
I see one down here, though, that is a bit familiar, because it's an old doo-wop song. And that's, Could This Be Magic?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's nice. I like that.
We did that, and still now and then on the internet, people comment on the rocker. They said the rocker doing doo-wops.
Well,
But it was a fantastic song. We got a good arrangement on it, I thought.
And the one really we have to mention, and that's the one that you wish you hadn't done, the Patty Cake.
The Patty Cake.
The twist. Everyone had to do a twist song.
Oh, yeah.
And you did that one. And surprisingly enough, it's quite collectible.
Oh, kids love it.
Yeah.
Not long ago, a songwriter that I had known for some time, his wife went into real estate, and there was some property near my home that she was looking at, and so she just came by, and she said, I would like to ask you a question. I said, okay, go ahead, I'll answer. She said, where could I get a copy of the Patty Cake? I said, I hope you never find a copy of it. But anyway, I ran her off a copy of it to take to her kids. She said that they heard it on, they were going, picking up stuff off the internet, you know, playing it, and they heard it on there. And they wanted a copy of it, so I told her, I said, take it to them and let them play. But a lot of people really liked it. I never did.
No, but the other one that I mean, you were these. By the way, these are all on Dot.
Yeah,
because Dot was your major label.
Well, after Moody River, the label couldn't do anything with Moody River. They turned me loose, and Dot signed me on Noel Ball was the producer, the disc jockey. And so he signed me with Dot, and I did several things for them.
One of the ones I really like, you've got For Sale, which is a great song, and one of the favorites. And I've got several favorites of yours, obviously, but it's A Handful of Friends.
Yeah.
And how did that come about? Do you remember?
There was a country version of that, and the guy that was doing my arrangements, Jim Hall, he really liked the song, the country version of it, but he said it needed violins and different voices and so forth, and he would like to put together an arrangement on it, and if we liked it, we could do it. If we didn't, why, he wouldn't even charge us for it.
Yeah.
And so he put it together, and we tried it and really liked it, and it made a nice record. It didn't sell a lot.
No, it didn't. But it had, for me, it had the Elvis feel.
Yeah.
And Elvis is a guy that you met and you went to the cinema with him once?
Yeah. I was in Memphis promoting Sweethearts in Heaven, as a matter of fact. And, of course, the disc jockeys in Memphis all knew Elvis. I mean, you know, they were just bosom buddies with him and all. And this one jockey that was doing the sock hop that I was going to play at, I can't think of his name right now, but he told me, he said, Elvis is going to have a movie showing tonight. Said he rents a whole theater and invites people in to see it, and we'd like for you to come over. And I said, well, sure, because I had never met him, you know. Even though he'd been in Nashville a lot, but we just never crossed paths. And so I went to the movie along with about 250 of his closest friends.
Well, at least you were there and you got to meet him, and that would be, what, about 62, something like that?
Yeah, 62 or 3. Something.
Yeah, I mean, that really is something. And and a little bit later we'll cover some of the others that, I mean, you've worked with so many people, so many great artists, country and and cowboy heroes from my boyhood.
Yeah,
you've worked with you know, wonderful stuff. Now we come to one that, this is how we got together.
Yeah.
You cut the original Like I've Never Been Gone, and you cut it on the 30th of August in 1962.
Yeah.
We never knew in the UK that there was any other version other than the one by our own Billy Fury, who made number three, I think. I should know, I'll get pilloried.
Yeah.
But certainly it was, you know, good top 10 hit, and my favourite song of all time. And your version is a great version. It's a little bit different, and the lyrics, slight lyric change.
Yeah.
But you had the original.
Yeah, this guy brought the song down from New York. I've forgotten the name of the publisher on it now, but... He brought some songs. He was a close friend, and he brought some songs from New York. He's responsible for the patty cake thing too. I never let him forget that.
I bet.
But he brought the song, and I think I gave you one of the copies of the song that dub they used to pitch it.
From New York.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of my most prized possessions. You didn't even tell me, and you sent it to me, and yeah, it's great. I don't even know, we don't know who is singing it, but...
Yeah,
but
it was a good arrangement, and the singer was good, which a lot of times the people that pitch songs to you, they do it in a hurry, and they're not very good, but this one was excellent. And we gave it to the arranger, and he said it was real easy to... you know, put everything together with it, because it had a good feel and everything when he listened to it the first time. And we got it cut, but I didn't sell any records. I don't know. I never caught on.
Which is so surprising, because it's not only a good song, your version is good. And it had hit written all over it, and you just didn't do it. And then, but you didn't know. At the time, you had, and until very relatively recently, you had no idea about Billy Fury and the hit or any of that, had you?
I heard about this was probably 2 or 3 years after I released the record. The same friend of mine came back in from New York, and he said he had heard that somebody in England cut the song, and it did good. But he didn't know who or how good it did or anything like that, and I didn't know until we started talking how good the record did over there.
Yeah, I mean, I was so pleased because you, I sent you some Fury stuff, Fury stuff, and I sent you some Marty Wilde, and Marty was kind enough to autograph one of his CDs for us. And I sent you some Cliff, and you'd been a bit aware of Cliff because he actually came over here and he had some play, but you didn't know about Marty and Billy, and yet you rate the pair of them, don't you? Quite highly.
Oh yeah. As a matter of fact, they the stuff that you've supplied me with from them is almost identical to everything that was happening here in the United States about a couple of years before they hit, and they're both fantastic artists. I mean, Billy, of course, you've supplied me with some of the stuff about him growing up and all that, and I can see why he would have women trouble. The boy was hot.
yeah, he was. And it's worth saying to anyone that doesn't know, that hasn't seen a photograph, that you had everything going for you yourself, in that when we see the clips on TV and the photographs, you know, you had the looks, you had the voice, you had exposure on television, you were on tour with all these people, and you know, you deserved to break big, not just in the South but all over the place. And you were one of those, I mean, you had Fabian and all that pretty ropey crowd, and they were getting the hits, and you were a genuine talent. And you were appreciated in your own hometown and surrounding counties, but never managed to crack national charts. And the sad thing.
Yeah, it's strange, but I attribute it to the old saying, the right time, the right place, the right people, and it'll happen. And I recorded for several different labels, but just about every label I recorded for was just about ready to go out of business, and I just pushed them over the edge. But they were really getting real cold when I signed with them. And their promotion, even though they sent me all over the country promoting these records, they didn't have the promotion people to get the records played.
Did you do Dick Clark or any of those?
I met Dick Clark in New York one time, and he told me if I had a record that got in the charts, that he would definitely put me on. But I never made the national charts for one, not enough for him to use me.
Well, one of the other great tracks here is you covered Uptown, the Orbison song, and actually you got to be there when he was recording and to meet him.
Yeah, I used to record at the same studio that Orbison recorded, and a lot of times we would be out remastering a record or adding something or something like that, and he'd be recording, and nice guy, but I hated him because he never missed a note. That guy, he and Marty Robbins were two of the people that I paid a lot of attention to when they were singing, and they just didn't hit bad notes.
Were you ever there when Marty was recording, Marty Robbins?
No, I was never at a recording session, but I did some shows that he was on.
So you shared the bill with him?
Yeah,
and he was great.
And of course, he was a member of the Grand Ole Opry, one of the biggest members they had at the time that I was a guest a few times. We were never on the same segment of the Opry, but at least I was at the Opry. I saw him do his numbers.
You moved from pop. I mean, your first love was probably country, because you grew up with country and it's all around you, and you couldn't be more country than Nashville, could you?
Right.
But then you did the pop, and you did great pop. And then you started to move with things like Suitcase and Cry Cry Darling and Find Out. Yeah. I love Find Out. That is a great, great track.
It's and, a good song.
And the rest of your stuff, then, apart from another version of Moody River, was country.
Yeah.
You know, and he cut some great stuff on various labels like Hickory, Showbiz.
Yeah.
And, yeah. There's a nice one. I think it's one of your favorites, The Love or the Wine.
Yeah. I wrote that.
You wrote that, yeah.
Yeah. And we cut it at the end of a session. I think Bill Graham, that owned the record company and all, we worked on one of his songs a little longer than we had planned. And we had very little time at the end of the session to cut this. And we had a piano player that had played for Elvis at one time or another.
Yeah.
And so he was the lead instrument on it, and he never would slow it down. he was doing it like a Jerry Lee Lewis ballad, you know. And so finally we just said, well, we'll take that. But it really is, I think it's a good song. And
there was one that wasn't issued, and it should have been, and that's For the Last Time.
Yeah.
In fact, Walkout was okay as well. So they never got issued, and they're still not issued, and they're in the can somewhere.
For the Last Time was never recorded on a label. That was a song that Patsy Willis and myself wrote, and that was a dub session. It wasn't even master session.
It wasn't. And but you've written quite a few songs. I mean, Where Is Your Heart Tonight is another one that you wrote, and you recorded that on the Hickory label, and that's a good song. So, you know, you've got the songwriting ability, you've got the voice, and the whole nine yards, you know. So,
but it just wore the body out.
But you had a good time doing it.
Oh, yes. Yes, yeah. I wouldn't take anything in the world for the sights I've seen, the places I've been, the people I've met.
Well, you were on TV. I've seen some of those clips that you've sent me, a few clips.
Yeah, we had about a little over a 2-year run on television, Dale Reeves Country Carnival,
which actually is available in I won't say it's commercially available, but it's around.
Sometimes you can find some of them on eBay, and now and then there will be a person that has several, you know, that will sell the whole bunch.
But you were resident there. You were the resident singer.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, and he seemed to think a lot of you. You got on really well together.
Yeah, we worked together for probably 7-8 years after the TV show quit. We were still working together.
So you go touring and...
Yeah.
Right. Now, some of the people you work with is a who's who. You know, and... You know, we talked about working with Jerry Lee Lewis.
Yeah.
And I guess we can do that again. And if we include the anecdote that you came out with just recently and told me, which sums him up, about the piano.
Jerry Lee is probably one of the greatest entertainers that you'll ever see walk on stage. And he's a fantastic piano player. And... he likes for the piano to be in tune. That is one of the things. Because I mean, that's like asking Chet Atkins to play a guitar with one string broken, you know. And so we were down around Montgomery, Alabama, somewhere down that way, playing on the outside. And it was hot and muggy. It had rained, and they had the instruments set up out in front of a building on the grass, wet grass. And so I went on and did my part, and I think we had a girl singer that did a few songs. And then Jerry Lee came out. And as soon as he sat down to the piano, I knew things wasn't going well because he hit that piano, he hit his chord, and it sounded like somebody was moving things around, you know. And so he said, "Could I have another piano, please?" And the promoter of the show waved him off, And so he started his show. And when he finished his show, that piano looked like it had been stripped down for reworking, because he took everything off of it, took the keys off of it. A lot of them were laying on the ground, which I don't blame him at all. I mean, he would do that if you gave him a bad instrument. But he did some fantastic shows. We, on that same tour, we played a club, and he was... A lot of times he was in great form, but even when he was just ordinary, he was still a showman. But there was some kind of women's convention going on, I think it was Atlanta where we were playing or something. And he walked down stage, and he always went through this thing of taking his rings off before he would sit down to play the piano.
Right, yeah.
And he must have spent at least 5 minutes looking at those women and taking his rings off and just taking his time before he ever even sat down to play. And once he sat down at that piano, he did a show that it would have been worth millions of dollars to anybody back before his fall. And he was just fantastic.
Now, it was just hard lines that
yep.
he went through all that. But then he switched the country, and he was great at country.
Yeah, he was just outstanding. But the funny thing about it, even though he could do country great, I mean, he was real convincing. He wasn't like a lot of pop artists that, well, I'll do country to make a little extra money. That wasn't a deal with Jerry Lee. If he said he was going to do country, he did country.
Oh, yeah.
And but the only thing about it, on his country shows, he even went back and picked up his rock and roll things and did that, and the crowd go along with it.
Jerry Lee is Jerry Lee, and that's
yeah.
it. But you also worked with a guy. I love this guy. His voice is really off the wall. But he's done some fantastic stuff, and that's Arthur Alexander.
Oh yeah, Arthur. I met him through a connection with Noel Ball, the guy that produced his first record, You Better Move On. They did it in a storehouse down in Alabama. And Rick Hall, that owns the big studio there now, that does all the big artists. Rick did this in a storehouse, and they brought it to Nashville to Noel, and so Noel signed Arthur on Dot, and they put this record out, which it got in the charts, but had it been on Atlantic or one of the rock and roll labels or rhythm and blues labels, that thing would have gone number one.
Were you there when it was recorded?
I was there when they reworked it. I wasn't there when they recorded, but later on we went to the studio where he recorded it and did some other stuff with other artists. But he was fantastic, and he had a sound that nobody else had. I mean, his voice and the way he phrased and his size. This guy was at least 6.5 feet tall. Great big dude, and he didn't do anything special but just stand up in front of that microphone and sing. And now and then he would point his fingers at the people, but there was no dancing, there was no nothing but just stand there and sing, and he'd just knock them out.
He was another Orbison in a way in that regard, just to stand
yeah.
there and perform.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you know, right. But and you've been kind enough to let me have a biography on him, and I thank you for that. But yeah, great. And then you were the Everly Brothers once.
Yeah, when I first started on the TV show with Noel Ball, the Saturday afternoon TV show, the Everlys were on it. And they had been working it for probably 6-8 months before I joined. And after I joined, I almost closed that show down. It only lasted about a year after I joined.
Just like the record label.
Yeah.
What did you think of them?
I put more people out of business.
they were good, weren't they?
Oh, they were. They were fantastic. And that was before they even had any records or anything. And Felice and Bootle O'Brien, two of the premier writers with Acuff Rose, wrote some songs for them. And that's really what got them started. And I worked one show with them after they got real popular, and I've forgotten where it was, but it was the best I remember. It was a thing where they were raising money for something. It was one of these charity shows, you know, that entertainers do. And when we all got ready to leave, why, they wouldn't let us walk out because all the girls was waiting for the Everlys. And so they put us in a limousine and tried to drive us out. And those girls were attacking that limousine. And I thought, boy, if I had a movie camera right now, I could say, they're after me. But that was a lie.
But you had a bit of that.
You had a lot of female adulation going on.
Yeah.
Yeah, sometimes they would get kind of rowdy, but you love it.
And then, of course, the guy that you work with that you think a lot of was Johnny Cash.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I got a curve thrown to me with Johnny. I had never met him. Of course, I had admired him ever since he'd been recording. And this guy that booked a show, that I knew the guy from Nashville, he lived there for quite some time. He booked some shows in Michigan. And back then they would book like a couple of big artists, and then fillers like me, you know, would get a date now and then on. And so I drove all the way to Escanaba, Michigan, which is the upper peninsula of Michigan, and got out of the car and went in this auditorium, and the guy that was booking the show met me there, and he said, how you feel today? I said, oh, great. Gonna have a good crowd? Yeah, we're gonna have a good crowd. You're gonna be the announcer. I said, I'm gonna do what? He said, you're gonna be the announcer, you're gonna introduce these people. I thought, me introduce Johnny Cash, that is ridiculous. And on that, Ray Price was the other act. And I was nervous. I mean, you just can't imagine how nervous you are when you think about, I've got to go out and say something good about Johnny Cash and not make a fool of myself.
Well, he's a hero, and that makes you tongue-tied.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, he was just... We had this conversation the other day that how great he was all the way through and how lived in, but right towards the end, that voice really was lived in.
Oh, yeah.
And when he does things like Hurt and stuff like that, how, you know, it really gets you. And but he was great on stage. I saw him once in Portsmouth, you know, the dressed in black thing, which came about by accident, apparently.
Yeah,
the story behind that, I didn't know. And he told his tailor he wanted some more suits, and he'd already had one done in black, and the tailor went off and made them all black. So from that minute on, he was a bit like Orbison. He was the man in black. But
he was so nice about, I went back to the dressing room and asked him, you know, if there was anything in particular that he wanted me to say. He said, nah, just tell him Johnny Cash, he'll be okay. But I didn't. I told him about all the number one records he'd had and everything. And after the show, he said, oh, you did a good job. And then after that, every time I'd see him,
he was fine.
He'd speak to me and talk to me and everything. And he even one time, he was being interviewed by a magazine, and somebody sent me a copy of it. And they were asking him about the future of Nashville. And he said, well, there's a few people that's coming on that's going to do okay in it. And said, Chase Webster's one of them. And I was floored by him saying that, because, I mean, you know, we'd talk every time we'd see each other and all, but I never thought that he'd heard enough out of me that he thought I would be the one to take over.
You can't get a bigger endorsement.
No.
You know, other than Elvis, perhaps, but yeah, that's a heck of a thing, particularly for country.
Yeah.
But associated with country, they don't like it anymore to talk that way, but going back, it was country and western.
Yeah.
And they don't like the term country and western. Oh, no, because that hayseeded and all that, you know, and the false Hollywood thing and all that. But we loved it. We grew up with cowboys.
Yeah.
And you're over there with a picture of you in a cowboy outfit.
Yeah.
So, you know, you had that. But you worked with the Bonanza crowd. You didn't actually work with Lorne Greene or Pernell Roberts, but you worked with some of the others.
I worked with Michael Landon, and who played Little Joe, and then also Dan Blocker played Hoss, and I was the front man for the band that played behind them at some rodeos.
Yeah,
and Michael Landon was—he was just a fantastic person. I mean, he was one of the most given people that you'd ever run into that was a big star. I mean, he didn't mind going to hospital, seeing kids before the show, or whatever you wanted to do, whatever you wanted him to do to make everything better.
So he was as nice as he, in real life, as people assume him to be.
Oh, yeah. Well, all the people that worked with him liked him. And when that happens with an actor, that's really something, because everybody's jealous of you. But that little house on the prairie, I've heard all those kids talk about how nice he was to them, how much he helped them, and all that kind of stuff. And then Dan Blocker, he was just a good old Texas country boy. he knew about riding horses and all that. Didn't bother him at all. And they always wanted the Little Joe or Danny wanted to come in on a horse, you know, and ride around the arena and wave to the people and all before they did the part of the show. And Dan Blocker, they would usually give him a pretty good horse, nice horse, one would kind of jump around a little. So they gave him a Pinto, and is a pretty horse, and he would ride up to the gate, and when they opened the gate, the spotlight would come on, real bright spotlight right on the gate, and that's when they introduced him, and he'd ride in. And this night, on that real pretty Pinto horse, they hit that spotlight, and that horse stood straight up. And his head hit a Blocker in the nose and bloodied his nose. He didn't stop and say, wait a minute, let me get this fixed. He would wipe his nose on his sleeve like that, riding around waving at the people, went all the way around, did the show and everything. But he had no, I've had a nosebleed before. It's not that bad.
No, yeah.
But he was just a real down-to-earth person. Well, and Michael too. I couldn't say anything bad about either one of them.
Now, you wanted to go through a fight scene with Michael, didn't you?
Yeah, we did a thing on stage when we played auditorium shows. We didn't do it much at rodeos, because rodeos, you had a little bitty, they either had a wagon or a trailer that you did your show from. You didn't have much room to work, but we did all the auditorium shows. We had a fight series. We went through a quick draw, and I would wear a gun, he would wear a gun, but he always would outdraw me, and you had different segments. We had a 50-cent fall, and a dollar fall, and a $5 fall, and a $5 fall, well, you just really jumped up and fell just flat out on the floor like you were really shot. And so I had a real nice Stetson hat that I wore. I thought, you know, wear that good hat because I'm doing rodeos and all this. And the first time that we did the $5 fall, why, my hat got it went across the stage and under a chair and all this. I thought, I'm going to buy me a cheap hat for this trick anymore.
I don't blame you, because as I found out this week, they can go up to $250 and $300 for a good Stetson.
Good Stetson. Of course, they last for years, but you don't want to tear it up on a $5 fall.
But the way that would work was that they would tell tales around a campfire type thing.
Oh,
well,
yeah.
And you'd be part of that. And Michael would try to sing?
Yeah, he sang when he worked with the Sons of the Pioneers. Of course, they would get right around him, and they were singing too, and they did Western songs. Well, when I took over, I didn't know any Western songs, because I didn't do Western songs.
You didn't do any Martin.
And he didn't sing. He admitted himself that he didn't sing well enough to carry it all by himself. He needed help.
Yeah.
And so we started doing some pop songs and some country songs, and I would sing with him. And it worked out good for us. We had a nice band, and so it worked out pretty good for us. But he recorded back before Bonanza. He recorded some stuff. I have a record by him that I wouldn't take anything in the world for. He was in a movie called The Werewolf.
Yeah.
And he recorded some stuff back then, and it wasn't commercial. I mean, it was just something somebody put together. But he was a fantastic entertainer. He could talk to the people and get more attention than a lot of people could if they go out and sing to them. I mean, it was funny how at a rodeo, you know, you think everything's kind of rough and rowdy and all that. You could hear a pin drop when he'd take over the microphone.
Well, once again, the women particularly loved him, didn't they?
Oh, yeah.
You know, you had it all going for him.
Yeah.
And then one time you met my main idol when I was growing up. I wanted to be 6'6", and I wanted to be Cheyenne Bodie. And who also sings. I found an album the other day of spirituals, and I tell you what, he can sing.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you met him.
Yeah, I met him through a guy that had a Western town, and he was putting together shows, you know, and bringing in artists, and he had worked for Cody, and on rodeos and stuff like that. I was doing some gunfights and stuff at his place, and met him there, and he's a real nice guy. Big son of a gun, but a nice guy.
I can imagine. He was kind enough to send me an autograph.
Yeah.
Many years ago now. He's still with us.
Yeah.
And but he was, yep. Yeah, he filled the screen, that's for sure. You didn't work with Carl Perkins or Ray Smith or any of the other Sun people?
I never worked with Perkins or any of those people. I mean, they were my idols and all, you know. Gene Vincent with Bebop Lula. I used to do that song all the time. I loved it. But I never met any of them. And Orbison and Johnny Cash, Jerry Lee is about
that's about
the
it.
Ones I knew from
well, I mean,
the
that's,
Memphis.
That's enough.
Oh well, yeah.
You know, and you didn't actually work with, but you've seen him live, Billy Crush Craddock.
Oh yeah, he did the TV show that we did with Del Rio's Country Carnival. He did that TV show, and he's a very good artist. But he reminds you so much of Presley. I mean, you know, his mannerisms, the way he dresses and all that kind of stuff. Back then, I don't know what he's doing now. I haven't seen him lately. But back then, just about all of his clothes kind of looked like copies of Presley. But he could sing.
Well, he was doing give him his due, he was doing that type of thing.
Yeah.
While Elvis was still with us.
Yeah.
So, you know, he he didn't sort of cash in.
Oh, no, no.
But of course, I didn't realize he started off as a rock and roller in Canada as well. And, you know, so he's got rock and roll roots and done some pretty good stuff, like Our Poor Little Baby and all of that. So you like Gene Vincent, you did Gene Vincent stuff. Did you ever, and you did little Jerry Lee stuff and you did Elvis stuff.
Yeah.
Did you ever do any Cochran or?
No. I don't think so.
No.
Yeah.
No, so that's the main sort of things. Okay, well, I wanted to sort of explore that connection because, I mean, you look back on your life and you can sit and talk about working with these wonderful people.
We missed was Jackie Wilson.
We spoke about Jackie yesterday.
Jackie Wilson, he was one of my idols. I couldn't sing his songs. Wouldn't even try. But he was so fantastic. I've always liked entertainers. I like people that go out and entertain, not just go out and sing.
Yeah.
And he did that. And I think I worked one show. I was on one show where he was the headliner. But I saw him work several times, and he was one of the hardest working people on stage. He would walk out with these beautiful outfits on, and when he left that stage, he would be wringing wet like somebody had thrown a bucket of water on him because he worked that hard.
I've got a film clip somewhere, and that's 70s.
Yeah.
And the way that he could move, I'm sure he could show James Brown a thing or two.
Oh, yeah.
And Elvis loved him. But it wasn't he one for the women?
Oh, yeah. Oh, women were crazy about him. He was one of the first artists, because I never did see Elvis live in a show, but he was one of the first artists that I noticed that they had security around the front of the stage to keep the women back. but he played Nashville, and Ray Charles was the only person that I had heard that he filled an auditorium in Nashville just back in the late 60s, early 70s. But when Jackie Wilson played it, he sold it out in just a couple of days.
That voice, no one's going to equal that voice.
No.
And you performed in the Ernest Tubb record store back then.
One of the things that was a highlight of the stuff that I've done, after I got out of basic training with the Air National Guard, I came back to Nashville, and I had kind of a burr haircut because I shaved my head. And anyway, this Noel Ball, he had been contacted by the guy that was head of the Grand Ole Opry, and they were downtown on that old Opry house then, the Ryman.
Yeah.
And he wanted to know if I would play the Grand Ole Opry, because the record had gotten so much publicity there in Nashville and everything. And so Noel contacted me. I said, sure, I'll play it. I said, you know, it's a big radio show. And so I went over to the Opry, and when I walked in, I almost panicked. People were just milling around and talking, and just like there was nothing going on. And out front on the stage, there would be some entertainer out there and just singing his heart out, and people just going crazy. And the people backstage all just milling around like nothing was going on. And this girl that kept the program, she came up and she said, you're going to be on at whatever time I was supposed to be. And she said, you'll be on Ernest Tubb portion. Well, I thought, you know, they have announcers.
Yeah.
I didn't know that Ernest Tubb was going to announce. And all of a sudden she said, you're next. And Ernest Tubb was standing in front of the microphone telling them about this young man in Nashville. And I about fainted, because, I mean, here's a guy that had been a star for years, introduced me on the Grand Ole Opry, and that was my first time on Opry. I thought, I'll go out and screw up in spite of everything I can do. I'll forget the words or something. But we made it through it. And the biggest memory of the Opry is every time I played the Opry, I got an encore every time I sung. I did Moody River and Sweethearts in Heaven, the songs that I did on the Opry, and every time I did them, I got an encore. And then Ernest, in that particular night, he invited me over to his record shop to do a couple of songs on the Ernest Tubb Midnight Jamboree.
All right, and so that followed on, yeah.
Yeah, but he was another nice guy too. He's just fantastic.
Well, we haven't managed to get a picture in the record shop, but they've got a few around the walls, or they did do in 2007 when I went in. But you've now got a picture in the revamped theater downtown in here in Franklin.
Yeah, they contacted me, I guess, when they were revamping the old theater. Wasn't doing any, you know, theaters, small theaters and all. They went out of business when they brought in these massive theaters with 15 different screens and movies showing all at the same time. And the old movie theater downtown, it was kind of dilapidated, outdated and all. And so they wanted to go in and rework the whole thing and make it where you could either show movies or you could have artists in. And they thought it would be a good idea, since so many of the artists and all live here in Williamson County, to let all of us put our picture and a little bio about what we'd done. And they just put it on the wall in the dressing room.
Yeah.
Or what they call the green room. And so they put me up along with some of the rest of the, I think, Sam McGee and Kirk. They put them up because they were members of the Opry for so long and all that kind of stuff. And I guess they got everybody else that lives in Williamson County and put them up on the wall.
Well, I had the privilege yesterday of being shown the Chase Webster Museum.
Oh, yeah.
up in the big house, you know, where your mum-in-law, Delly Mangrum, lives in that house, and you know, your wife's mother.
Yeah.
And they've all been so gracious to us. And part of the house is, one of them's Gone with the Wind room.
Yeah, that was my wife's niece. She was raised in that house, and she was a Gone with the Wind freak. Everything had to be Gone with the Wind, you know, from several years back. And so they fixed up a room.
But your brother-in-law now has done the... your wife's brother, yeah.
Yeah.
He's gone and got hold of your stage suit.
Yeah.
And got hold of some of your records and photographs and a file and put it in one of the rooms. So when the tourists come through, the heritage tourists to come through to look at the, because it's got Civil War history.
Yeah.
With the Confederacy, of course. Because it was lived in by a Confederate Army officer at one stage. Which I found a great interest, as you know, because that's one of my things.
Yeah.
It's the Confederacy, but do we talk about that ever? But anyway, great that you've got a museum so that when these people come in now to see that Gone with the Wind era house, 1822 or whenever it was built, they come and see that, that they're going to bump into Chase Webster. I mean, you won't maybe be sat there in the rocking chair.
Yeah. In a few years, I can be sitting in the rocker.
Sitting in the rocker with your Stetson on and the music playing. And, you know, but it's great that you've managed to salvage some of those stage outfits and that there is a record, and so they should be, because this is your area, this is where you were famous, and, you know, it's great. Well, I'd like to say a big thank you to you and to Donnie, of course, you're a good wife. The hospitality to Linda and myself during this trip has been, well, it's been wonderful.
Well, we've enjoyed having you, and the second trip. We'd like for you to bring back a third trip.
Just
anytime you want to come back, because you're good people, and I've enjoyed talking with you. And if you want to write something, go ahead and do it.
Thank you very much indeed. Yeah, I will do. Cheers.
And I won't contest anything you say, because I'm not sure that I would remember.
Well, I think you've done a pretty good job. Because when we first interviewed, we did it over the telephone in 2004, because it came out in the Sound of Hearing magazine in 2005. And we spent several hours doing those interviews. And the thing is that I've got the audio, but we were doing it and then cutting and then having a break and then changing tapes. So I've got stuff all over the place, you know, quite a bit. And I know we've covered some of it again, but is there anything else that you can think that of your career and your life that we haven't touched on, you know, the records or anything that we could?
No, not really, but there's one thing I'd like to add to it, is that Billy Fury, of course, he's no longer with us, but his legacy has lived a lot longer than a lot of artists live. And it's because, one thing, because he was a fantastic artist. And the next thing is he connected with the people. And that's what so many artists don't do. They don't connect with the people. But he did, and he was a fantastic artist. And even though he's been gone all these years, he still has a fantastic following.
Chase, that's very nice of you to say that. And someone asked me just recently, they're writing a book about Billy, and they said, why have you taken the time to do what you do? And I said, well, partly because I was a teenage idol.
Yeah.
He was a teenage idol of mine. But also because on the time that I met him, he was gracious. He couldn't have been more polite. He couldn't have been nicer.
Yeah.
A bit like Jim Proby when I met him. And my goodness, he's got a reputation. But to Linda and myself, he was the perfect Southern gentleman. And I've got such a soft spot for the South.
Yeah.
Being a good old Cornish Southern boy myself. But it's nice you should say that about him. He was special. His love, particularly by the women. But we all wanted to be him.
Yeah.
And the women, well, you know what they wanted. But they wanted to mother him, and they wanted to, you know, be with him. And, you know, he had something that Elvis didn't have. He had the vulnerability.
Yeah.
So he had the looks, the vulnerability, and the voice. And he may have sounded a bit sharp, but some of that stuff is just great. I mean, you know, his version of It's Only Make-Believe, you try and, you know, take that on after Conway Twitty. And Halfway to Paradise, which, you know, Tony Orlando, great little voice, great little guy, only 15 at the time, but Billy aces it with that Halfway. I really appreciate you saying that about Billy, and I said, I know you like Marty as well, and some of the Cliff, and from my perspective, that someone like yourself, who has had such a history over here, where rock and roll began, and with country, and with the really great artists, can turn around and say that you rate and you really like the UK ones who came along on a wave afterwards, you know, that says a lot for the credibility of those UK artists. You know, so I appreciate that. Anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And, time for another beer, probably.
I would say about now.
about now, and the girls are gone shopping, and that sounds good.
And we'll give you that good old Southern thing. You come back here.
Well, we really wish circumstances dictated otherwise, but it's taken us 10 years, but we made it.
Good. Very good.
Thank you, Chase.
Thank you.